In the 2016 election, the Washington Post found only 4 documented cases of voter fraud out of 135 million votes cast. It was 0.00002% of total votes.
This program is made possible by the members and donors to the show. To support the work we do, get commercial-free versions of every episode, and occasional members-only bonus content, visit the Contribute tab at bestoftheleft.com. Now, welcome to the award-winning Best of the Left podcast with clips today from Start Making Sense, The David Pakman Show, The Other Washington, The Bradcast, and Democracy Now!
Now it's time to talk about voting rights, where we stand now. For that, we turn to Ari Berman. He's a senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and a fellow at The Nation Institute. His award-winning book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, is out now in paperback. Ari Berman, welcome back.
Thank you.
With everything going on in Trump land, sometimes it's hard to focus on the fundamental issues, and voting rights is certainly fundamental. We want to talk about where we stand with voting rights at this point, where the battles are, what challenges we face, how we can prepare for the 2018 midterm elections. The Democrats need to win, I think it's 24 seats in order to retake control of the House. That's the plan. But in order to do that, Democrats have to be able to vote. We know the Republican strategy for a while now has been vote suppression. Democratic victories depend on voter turnout. Jeff Sessions is our attorney general. What has he done since taking office about voting rights?
So I think it's important first to note that Jeff Sessions has a very long record of opposition to voting rights, which makes him quite unique as an attorney general. We've never had someone who became attorney general and had previously prosecuted civil rights activists for voter fraud, which Jeff Sessions did back when he was a U.S. attorney in Alabama in the 1980s. He's someone who said that the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in 2013 was good news for the South. When he was nominated as Attorney General, he was asked to refute Donald Trump's lie that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally. And Jeff Sessions said, "I don't know how many people voted illegally," which was not exactly a very clear refutation of what Trump said. And one of the first things that that Sessions has done as Attorney General has been to reverse the Justice Department's position in the Texas voter ID case and argue that that law was not intentionally discriminatory, which was very, very significant because if Texas's voter ID law is found to be intentionally discriminatory and there's just a trial over this in February, then Texas may have to once again approve its voting changes with the federal government. So this was just the first thing Sessions has done, and it was kind of forced upon him because the court was going to have a hearing. But I'm fully expecting there will be lots of bad positions taken by the Justice Department on voting rights and on many other issues going forward under Sessions.
Well, Texas has been one of the worst states in trying to limit voter rights. Of course, it's by no means the only one. Where are the other battlefronts right now?
So just stepping back a little bit, 21 states since the 2010 election have passed new restrictions on voting, whether it's voter ID laws or cutting back on early voting or shutting down polling places or purging the voting rolls. And, you know, this has happened across the country in important swing states like Florida and Ohio and Wisconsin, and then in sort of redder states like Texas. And 14 of these new restrictions were in effect for the first time in 2016. And we saw a depressed turnout in places like Wisconsin and North Carolina because of this. Now we're in a situation in 2017, some of those states are still pushing forward with new restrictions and other states are getting in on the game. Right now there are 78 bills to restrict voting rights in 21 states. a few states have already passed new measures. Arkansas just passed a voter ID law. They had tried to pass a similar law in 2014, but it was struck down by the state Supreme Court as unconstitutional. Now they're trying again. Iowa, which is under Republican control, has passed legislation to require ID, also to cut early voting, to eliminate straight ticket voting. So that's a state that has previously not done these kind of things, that went for Obama twice and now went for Trump in 2016. So that's another place I'm looking at. But there's a bunch of bills in a number of different states. That's just at the state level. And of course, the dynamic that's now different is there's also a different regime federally. So before, you had the Obama administration who was fighting back on this stuff. You had, at the very least, divided control of Congress. So Congress was out of the game. Now you have Republicans in Washington who are supporting these state efforts. And that's what's new and disturbing here.
Well, I know the ACLU and other voting rights groups and projects are challenging a lot of these restrictions in court. Some are succeeding. A lot of them are not succeeding. But there's also a parallel effort to help voters get the ID they need. What can you tell us about this effort, and is it going to make sufficient progress between now and 2018?
I think there's been a few different ways on which these efforts to suppress the vote have been combated. As you mentioned, there have been a lot of lawsuits filed. The ACLU and other groups have had some success in places like Texas and North Carolina. Those cases, though, remain unsettled because a lot of them are on appeal. A lot of them are on appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has deadlocked 4-4 in a lot of these cases. So Neil Gorsuch could be the deciding vote to make sure that voting restrictions in North Carolina and Texas and other places are allowed to go into effect, which I think would be catastrophic for voting rights in those states. At the same time, there are 100 federal court vacancies that Donald Trump is going to begin to fill. So when you're talking about court of appeals, district court decisions, those could go another way. So that's why the judiciary is really, really important here. And I'm really concerned about what might happen under Trump. There are efforts underway by groups like Vote Riders, by Project Vote and others, to try to help people get the IDs they need. I observe these efforts up close in states like Wisconsin, where they had organizers on the ground. They did a good job, but it's very, very difficult work. I mean, the people who, for example, might not have the right voter ID, these are often people from underserved communities, people at the lower end of the economic ladder, and they need a lot of help. This sometimes requires multiple trips to the DMVs. You have situations where people don't have birth certificates, or they have errors on their birth certificates, and it's very, very difficult to get the documentation. So this can be extremely time-consuming work. It's really important organizing, but when people say, well, let's just get everyone the ID, I mean, it's not nearly as simple as you think for those people that don't have it, and that's just one component of this problem. So I think we need to see a lot more attention and a lot more funding for this work going forward.
And of course, while voter ID has gotten probably the most attention, there's also been the changes in polling place, the reduced number of polling places for minority communities, student communities. Where do we stand on those tactics?
Those tactics are ongoing. And that's what I always try to bring attention to, is it's not just voter ID, because a lot of people are hung up on this idea that everyone has the ID and you need it for all this other stuff. And what's the big deal? And, you know, I've pushed back on that in a lot of different ways, talking about how not everyone has the ID and the laws are written in such a way, like in Texas, where you can vote with a gun permit, but not a student ID. So clearly seems like there's some other motives here. But even if you accept that voter ID is necessary, then you still have to think about, why would you cut early voting, which is very popular among party lines? Or why would you close polling places, which nobody wants to do? Or why would you purge the voting rolls without notifying people in advance? That kind of stuff is also going on here. And these efforts are ongoing. And a lot of times we don't have advance notice of them. And they, you know, there's a number of states in 2018 and in 2020 that are going to be competitive, that are going to have these efforts going forward. So it's not just voter ID. I think it's really, really important to look at. That's what always gets the headline, but there's a lot of other things going on here. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Right on.
Let's talk a little bit about voter suppression. In Wisconsin in 2016, 300,000 registered voters, or about 9% of the electorate, didn't have voter IDs that adhered to Wisconsin's pretty strict voter ID laws. We now have a new study by Priorities USA, and it argues that Wisconsin's voter ID laws reduced voter turnout by 200,000 votes and disproportionately affected Black voters and Democrats. 200,000 people not voting because of voter ID laws. Donald Trump won Wisconsin by only 22,748 votes. Simple math that most of us can do suggests that the new voter ID laws pushed by Republicans, including in Wisconsin, may have given Donald Trump Wisconsin in the 2016 election. The study contrasted voter turnout in states with similarly strict voter ID laws to states without such laws. We have a chart that we can put up for you related to this. And as you can see, the states that made no changes to their voter ID requirements saw turnout go up from 2012 to 2016. States that changed to go to less strict voter ID laws also saw an increase in turnout from 2012 to 2016. And as you can see at the bottom line, states that changed their voter ID laws to stricter laws saw a nearly 2% decline in voter turnout. That's something that Republicans like, because Republicans do better when voter turnout is lower. Let's now go, Pat, to our next graph. Throughout the entire country, the study estimates that strict voter ID laws suppressed about 400,000 votes, again, disproportionately affecting Black people. And the study compared numbers between Wisconsin and Minnesota, a state with similar demographics to Wisconsin, but no strict voter ID laws. And if you're looking at this graphic, the green line is Black Minnesota voters over recent elections. And as you can see, turnout just ever so slightly lower in 2016 than in 2012. And if you look at the yellow line, you will see that Black Wisconsin voters had significantly voter turnout from 2012 to 2016. This isn't the only study that says this. It's consistent with a GAO study from 2014, which showed that, yes, strict voter ID laws affected the 2012 election enough to change election results, suppressing young and minority voters. Of course, this is the case. This is what these laws are made to do. This is what Republicans want. This helps Republicans win. Remember this video, damning video, from Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Tarzai in 2012?
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Right. It's not a secret. They've been honest about this for a while. Lower turnout is good for Republicans, or just for the more conservative candidate that's running.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that they support voter IDs just out of principle and not because they know it'll give them a benefit in the upcoming elections.
31 states ask for some form of ID at the ballot, 15 ask for photo ID, and bills that would intensify voter ID laws have been introduced in 19 states so far this year. Iowa and Arkansas have already passed laws like that in 2017. But again, solutions to problems that don't exist. Voter fraud, the way Republicans describe, is not a problem. There were something, like you were saying, Pat, four instances of in-person voter fraud during the 2016 election, and yes, three of them were Republican voters.
I mean, it's so statistically insignificant, and those four cases fall far short of the 3 to 5 million people that Trump claims voted illegally in that election.
Right, yeah, as if we still are going to pretend that there was even a chance that that was a real thing. We should also be voting on weekends, or at least have an election day be a federal holiday. I've mentioned that before. But you've got to make the IDs easier to get. People say, hey, the voter IDs are free. That's not really true. Very often you need documents in order to get the voting ID that you have to pay for copies of. Very often people have to travel, which has costs, to the place where you can get one of those voter IDs. And also, many people who work hourly jobs during business hours have to take time off from that job in order to go and get the ID. And that's money that they're going to lose. And not only that, they could also get fired. In a lot of hourly jobs, you can't just say, I'm going to go get a voter ID, give me time off. There are repercussions for that.
Yeah, and those voter IDs have to be completely free, because otherwise it violates the 24th Amendment, which bans a poll tax.
If a Republican says, how hard is it to get an ID? You're just trying to get more minorities to vote. that's also not really a criticism. Like, are you arguing it's bad for more people to vote? Are you saying we would be better off if our representative democracy was only representative of a smaller portion of the people in the country? Republicans know that they can't continue to win on policy alone, and they have to keep voters as white as possible. And that's what's behind a lot of these proposals.
How much time did you have to take off this year to cast a ballot?
Well, oh, man, I had a hard time finding the stamp in my wallet. And
which is where you keep your stamps.
Which is where I keep my stamps.
And you only have them for voting.
I only have them for voting because Washington is one of three states now, which is an all vote by mail state.
Correct.
Which means that we get our ballots in the mail. We fill them out on our own time. We put a stamp on them. We drop them in the mail, or we drop them without a stamp in a drop box. And your ballots are counted. There's no waiting in line. There's no broken polling machines.
You don't have to go anywhere.
No.
I voted in my jammies this year with like a hot toddy in my hand. Paul, did you take off any time to vote?
I did not. I voted in an evening. I sat down with the voter's guide that was provided to me and went through and made choices based on that. And
so you also got to have resources with you, which is the other great thing.
It's an open book test.
It is an open book test. Yeah, you get to have your notes and you can like Google and
I
look
had
at
the
stuff.
Google. Yes, yep. Yes. And I did. I'm a snail mail guy. I like mailing things, so I always have my Batman stamps. Although now I have some Wonder Woman stamps on my fridge that I'm very excited about using.
Still with her, huh?
Yes. But I do think that it would be great if Washington State had postage paid, because that even that is a barrier for voters.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. And King County has been experimenting with a little bit of postage paid recently. A couple of the really small, like school, like one on Vashon Island, I think. They've been trying it out to see whether or not it increases voter turnout, which it has. And the real question is whether or not it's like worth the cost. But we've already cut the cost by doing vote by mail.
You know, to borrow a title from your guests, your later guest book, we want the best democracy money can buy. And if the cost of it is a first class stamp, I think it's a bargain.
Right. And also, by the way, that's just money that goes from one government hand to the other, because it's the post office, which I think we all agree is something that we like want to keep operational and help support.
So the great thing for folks outside of the West Coast who aren't used to the whole vote by mail thing, there's vote by mail in every state. In every state, in every jurisdiction, you can get an absentee ballot. The question is, what are your absentee ballot laws? Is it something that you can only do if you verify you're going to be out of state the way it is in my native Pennsylvania? Is it something you can request every time regardless? Or is it something where you can put yourself as a permanent absentee as you can do in some states? In Washington, there's no choice. Everybody is essentially an absentee voter and gets their ballots in the mail. And the great thing about this is that much of the voter suppression laws that you see going around nationwide, voter ID, et cetera, is intended specifically to suppress the vote. And you can't do any of that stuff with vote by mail because there's no polling place. There's no ID to show. You're either a registered voter or you're not. And if by chance your ballot doesn't show up, you've got 3 weeks. You can request another ballot. You can go online and print one out.
You can print it like the day it's due. Like you can print it. I was telling people, if you've lost your ballot, like that does not mean that you're out of the game. We make it very easy, even though we don't pay postage, for people to vote. I personally have never waited in line to vote. I have never had to go to a polling place. My entire voting life, I grew up in Oregon and now I'm here. I have been able to mail my ballot in. And the idea that I would have had to take a day off of my job as a waitress to stand in line, like I wouldn't have done it. I can tell you that I wouldn't have done it. And so even that, like the fact that the rest of the country has been so slow to adopt vote by mail, I think is very indicative of the larger view about like who gets to vote and who can vote. Voting day is not a national holiday. you can't, like, I can't imagine calling in sick.
It is a crime against our democracy every election day when you see those scenes of people waiting in lines for hours where they have to go to court to extend the hours of the polling places because they've run out of ballots or a machine is broken. It doesn't happen here in Washington State. It never happens here in Washington State. Republicans could take over. We have a Republican Secretary of State. It still doesn't happen.
I mean, she is trying her damnedest to make it a little harder by adopting a real ID. But
you know, she's not evil by national Republican standards.
No, she is not.
It's all relative. So one of the first things I think, if you made me benevolent dictator, I would do is do national vote by mail.
Yeah.
Where everybody has the right to be a permanent absentee voter.
Can I just say, though, my favorite part of the voting by mail process, which people who live in states that don't have vote by mail may not know about, is I vote the minute my ballot arrives in the mail. I send it back the next day.
I know where
then,
you're going.
Yes, you can look up on a website whether your ballot has been received. And
yes.
There's a screen. You get a green check. It's better than the sticker that you get at the ballot
so
box.
Much better.
Because it says your ballot has been received and your vote will be counted.
Yeah,
and it's such a relief. It was a relief for me in 2016, you know, before actually election night happened, to know that I had voted for my candidate and that my vote had been counted. It was such a relief for me as a citizen. I felt like I was, yes.
You know, there's an extra bonus to that, which is that not only can you look up and see that you voted, the campaigns can look up and see that you voted. Nobody knows how you voted, but they know that you voted, so they stop calling you.
Yes. Yeah. If you are done getting phone calls, vote early.
Yeah.
Well, so I think this is something, I mean, obviously Washington has been vote by mail for some time. Oregon has been vote by mail for some time. What can people in other, like, what do you do if you're in an other, if you're in one of the lesser states than out here on the West Coast? If you don't want to have to wait and stand in a fucking line, like in the rain, it's November when you vote. Right? Like in the snow, what do people do?
What do they do?
Yeah, what should they do?
What should they ask their elected leaders to do?
They should ask their elected leaders.
Well, they should ask them for vote by mail.
Yeah, they should.
That's right. Remember also, the other great thing about vote by mail is it's a paper ballot, which means there is, by definition, a paper trail. There is no way for the Russians to hack in and throw a vote by mail election, because even if you went and hacked the voting machines, you've got all the paper ballots there. They do a statistical sample. You can do hand recounts of the ballots. And we had a hand recount in 2004 of over 3 million ballots statewide and statistically insignificant number of changes from the original count to the final count.
I mean, that's the other thing, is it is actually more secure too. Like a large amount of voter suppression is characterized as being, you know, like voter suppression tactics are to make the vote more secure, are to reduce.
ID.
Yeah. Voter ID is to reduce fraud. There is almost no better way to reduce voting fraud than to switch to paper ballots.
Also, in terms of voters who aren't eligible or voters voting twice, and remember, we said before, you can print out a ballot, you can print out as many as you want. Only the first one they receive is counted. They know it's there's no way to actually mail in multiple ballots.
And you have to sign it, and they do check your signature. They verify your signature, and
that is one of the downsides is that a certain percentage of the ballots are left uncounted because people did not sign the ballot, but the envelope.
Right.
Because this is a secret ballot.
Yep.
They do not sign it, or their signature doesn't match. Mm-hmm. So there are a percentage there. But when you work that into the larger numbers compared to other systems, it just works out so much better, and it's so much harder to suppress that vote. But I would say, again, on that issue of voter fraud, that there is no record of it. The other reform you should ask for is automatic voter registration. That's something we don't have in Washington State, which we should. If you're eligible to vote, you should be able to get it back. They should register you for you.
Well, and there's a lot of ways that we could still expand voting, pre-registration, you know, so that you register before you turn 18. But by the time, if you're 18 at the time of the election, you know, you don't have to go like register to vote the day of, and yeah, automatic voter, motor voter registration. But I, the hard thing for me is there seems to be two different views on who should be able to vote. Like that's what so much of this voter suppression and requiring people to
mean white people versus people of color
and people with money, like people who can drive to a point, you know, sometimes polling places are really far out. Sometimes they're, you know, you vote in the middle of the day when most people have to work.
Yeah.
Like there are so many ways that we make it just a little more hard to vote. If you are not a person who has paid leave, if you are not a person who has a motor vehicle, if you are not like, we don't make any attempt to make sure that polling places are on bus lines. We don't make sure that, you know, like there's no concessions being made. And the thing that seems so strange to me is that more working people aren't mad at what a gigantic ordeal voting is for them.
They don't know any better.
Because they don't. Yeah.
You know, an interesting history in Washington State, Oregon was the first state to do all vote by mail.
Hell yeah, Oregon.
Right. Washington shortly thereafter implemented permanent absentee balloting so that you could just put yourself on the rolls and anybody could vote by mail if they wanted. And gradually, county by county, they started individually moving to all vote by mail because it was cheaper and easier than running two different voting systems. But in King County, where we live, the largest county in the state and the largest vote-by-mail jurisdiction in the country, all vote-by-mail jurisdiction, what you had for years early on was that the early vote came in Democratic, because that was the election day stuff that was counted, and then the mail-in ballots were largely from what were then Republican suburbs, the red areas of the county. Republicans were voting by mail, and Democrats were voting at the polls because Democrats were largely concentrated in Seattle, and the Republicans were distributed throughout the county. So Republicans embraced it. They embraced it because it made it easier for Republicans to vote. Once the entire state, except for King County, was all vote by mail, Republicans resisted allowing King County to go all vote by mail because they knew they had an advantage there. So you have this example where Republicans know that vote by mail increases turnout. They would just rather it's only their people that turn out. So if you're worried about having your vote counted out in rural America, out in the exurbs where it's harder to get to a polling place, my God, you should be supporting vote by mail.
When our phones are our very own tailor-made media universes and our social media feeds are seeded with opinions and lies, how can we possibly find common ground, especially when our politicians are getting more entrenched by the day? Thankfully, there is one way to maintain a level of frankness and transparency in your media. Listen to On the Media, WNYC's weekly investigation into how the media shapes our worldview. While maintaining the civility and fairness that are the hallmarks of public radio, the team at On the Media tackles sticky issues and untangles this era's most intractable questions. Brooke Gladstone and Bob Garfield are your hosts on a search for the truth in a 24-hour news cycle. I began listening to On the Media at least 12 years ago, maybe slightly more, and I've probably heard every podcast episode they've put out since then. I don't think I can say that about any other news and politics show. Now, if that's not a full-throated endorsement, I don't know what is. So catch them on their weekly podcast, On the Media, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On October 4, 2016, this was last year, in the heat of the presidential election, October 4, in Indiana, just before the Hoosier State's October 11 deadline to register for the November 8 presidential election, in which then Indiana Governor Mike Pence was on the ticket as the vice presidential candidate on October 4. An investigation into alleged voter registration fraud had intensified rapidly on that day when state police reportedly raided the Indianapolis office of a voter registration group and confiscated computers, personal cell phones, and paperwork. According to a report from The Intercept at the time, The Intercept reported that workers at the site told them that state police had stopped one person from recording the incident at all, and that the group's lawyer had said he was unable to enter the building. State police were investigating at the time the Indiana Voter Registration Project's effort in 9 counties across Indiana after claims that the group had fraudulently registered voters. That, according to the Indianapolis Star, Indiana's Secretary of State Connie Lawson, who was a key sponsor of Indiana's 2005 photo ID law that went all the way to the Supreme Court, where it was upheld, she had announced the investigation in September. According to The Intercept, Lawson alleged that, quote, nefarious actors are operating here in Indiana. She said a group by the name of the Indiana Voter Registration Project has forged voter registration, serious charges, which, of course, led to this raid at the Indiana Voter Registration Project's office. Patriot Majority is the D.C.-based group who is managing the voter registration drive in Indiana with the Indiana Voter Registration Project. Its leader, Craig Verogo, told the Intercept that it's not unusual that they would turn in questionable forms and flag them to election officials. We have gone over this many, many times over many, many years in regard to the Acorn story. You will recall that back then they were claiming that Acorn was turning in all of these fraudulent registrations. It was voter fraud, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the rule of law is that even if you get a fraudulent registration or registration that is defective in some way, you still must turn that in to officials. You flag it and say, hey, we have questions about this registration form, but you turn it in. You can't not turn it in.
Right, because as a voter registration organization, you are not the person who's supposed to decide whether that person gets registered. That's up to the Secretary
of State.
Officials
or the county officials. Exactly.
To verify who you are. You don't want some schmo on the street who's getting paid to do a voter registration drive to decide whether you get to vote.
Whether it's valid or not. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, those are weasel words, and it's intentionally misleading for them to pretend like there was something wrong with them turning in fraudulent registrations.
Yet that's what they were pretending, that there was something, that this was some big scam. And but it wasn't unusual that they turned in those forms. What was unusual, according to election law experts at the time, is for police to raid a voter registration office and take all of their gear and, of course, do so in the proximity to an election. Just barely 1 month before an election, and in this case, about 7 days before the registration deadline would cut off in Indiana. Dan Takagi, an election law professor at Ohio State University, said that he was worried that such a raid, if it happened in the manner described in the news reports, and it did, that it would have a chilling effect potentially on voter registration drives across the country just 1 month out from the election. Takagi said, my concern is it's going to intimidate people who are registering to vote. There is nothing that affects turnout on election day more than voter registration, Takagi said. Voting registration is really the big thing. If you make it more difficult to register, you will decrease the number of people who vote. These sorts of law enforcement activities are extremely worrisome. That's what was going on in early October, October 4, in the state of Indiana. The next day, according to the Indianapolis Star, they said Indiana State Police, remember, this is the state police investigators, had searched a voter registration agency on Indianapolis's north side as they look into a voter fraud case that spans 9 counties. So now you got Indianapolis Star calling it a voter fraud case, not a voter registration fraud case, but a voter fraud case that spans 9 counties in Indiana. They reported that police said the growing number of involved counties leads investigators to believe that the number of fraudulent records might be in the hundreds. According to state police, the possible fraudulent information is a combination of fake names, addresses, and dates of birth with real information, the Star reported. According to a state police statement at the time, an investigation of this nature is complex, time-consuming, and is expected to continue for several more weeks or months. Victims of the activities by some agents of the Indiana Voter Registration Project may not discover they have been disenfranchised from voting. So now the police are already declaring that there are victims here, that Indiana Voter Registration Project has, you know, fraudulently disenfranchised people from voting. Again, this is the state police in the run-up to the election, just days before the registration deadline in the state of Indiana. Now, we've been, you know, talking over the many months about the, you know, the inappropriate announcements made by James Comey last year, because the Department of Justice has a rule, essentially, that you do not take these sort of actions just days prior to an election. You don't take criminal action. You don't file charges in a way that may affect elections. And here you've got the Indiana State Police going out and making these outrageous statements that this group has committed essentially massive fraud. The president, again, of Patriot Majority, Craig Verroga, said because the IVRP, the Indiana Voter Registration Project, had been specifically referenced in that statement from both the state police and from the Secretary of State, that the investigation could likely impede the processing of some 45,000 voter registration cards that had been completed through the organization across the state. And he later went on to say that another 10,000, because they shut them down, they shut this group down at the time, another 10,000 or so registrations they might have collected prior to the October 11 deadline last year. He said the IVRP uses quality control procedures in an effort to catch issues with voter registrations. He said any of the applications that had been earmarked as fraud were already earmarked by the IVRP as incomplete or incorrect when they were handed in to the counties or the state. For example, he said if someone transposes digits in a phone number or forgets to fill out their zip code, the canvasser cannot complete that information for them. They got to turn it in as is. Verroga said that card would then be flagged before being turned over to the local clerk's office. If they transpose a number and that's inaccurate, that's a mistake. He said that's not fraud. Verroga says he does not know the status of those 45,000 applications, but said the seizure of cell phones and laptops during Tuesday's search warrant impedes the organization from further registering people to vote before the October 11 deadline. The investigation, he said, is a partisan effort designed to make it harder to vote in this election. State Police Captain David Burstyn said at the time that the complexity of the investigation likely means that the work will continue until well after the November elections. He said, "We wouldn't be investigating if we weren't still finding issues that are indicative of fraudulent acts. This is not the Secretary of State's investigation. This is the Indiana State Police's investigation," he said. The Indiana State Police, run by who? The governor of the state of Indiana. Who was the governor of the state of Indiana at the time that all of this was going on? That would be now Vice President Mike Pence, of course. A few days later, actually on October 11, which was the registration deadline in Indiana, then Vice Presidential candidate Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, was speaking at a rally in Newton, Iowa, where he was asked by a distraught voter who was terribly worried, very concerned about voter fraud, all of these stories they've been hearing, you know, from places like the Indianapolis Star reporting this major effort in county after county across the state of Indiana from this Democratic leaning group who was registering voters. She was very, very distraught about all of these reports she's hearing, wondered what Mike Pence was going to do about it in Indiana, in Iowa, all across the country. Here is some of her question and Mike Pence's response on that day.
My name is Rhonda.
Rhonda?
And I'm on social media every day, all day, nonstop, pushing Trump. And one of the biggest things I can tell you that a lot of us are scared of is this voter fraud. There's a lot of us that are out here saying that we go to vote, we're going to wear red. Our lives depend on this election. Our kids' futures depend on this election. What are we going to do to safeguard our votes? Because
Girl, look,
we've seen how the Democratic Party is just crooked, crooked, crooked.
Well, look, I'll tell you, number one, it's, you know, elections are administered at the state level. They are. And I'll tell you, in the state of Indiana right now, we got a pretty vigorous investigation into voter fraud going on right now. And let's make sure that our elected officials are upholding the principle of one person, one vote. And if you are concerned about voter integrity and you haven't signed up to be a poll watcher, to volunteer at a polling place, to be a part of the integrity of that process, then you need to do it.
Now, of course, I agree with his call for them to sign up to be a poll watcher, to be a poll worker and so forth. That's fine. But this vigorous investigation into voter fraud, it wasn't into voter fraud. It was into voter registration fraud. And it was at his behest. So he's got this terribly distraught woman asking her. She's so concerned that the election is going to be rigged because, you know, that's what Donald Trump had been saying. And Republicans have been saying for years that there's massive voter fraud going on. Instead of calming her down, you know, he just fed into it. This vigorous investigation into voter fraud right now. And he talked about voter integrity. As I have said many times, the voters are doing just fine. Leave them alone. If you're worried about integrity, it's the integrity of our elections themselves and the way they are run and the way they are counted and the way voters are kept from being able to vote at all and the way state police thugs are sent in to take out tens of thousands of voter registrations in the days before an election, as we saw from Mike Pence's state police force last year in October, before he then went on to scare them further with this vigorous investigation into voter fraud. That was October 11. That was the day that the registration deadline in Indiana itself. About a week or so later, as Indiana State Police were continuing their investigation into the alleged voter fraud issue in the state, one county prosecutor, the county prosecutor who would bring charges in this case, said that the charges, the talk of voter fraud is, quote, without merit. Marion County prosecutor Terry Curry told the Indianapolis Star in a statement that accusations of voter fraud are premature as the state cops were still investigating. Curry specifically called on investigators to stop discussing the investigation until it is finished. Stop putting out statements, making these claims about this group. Confidentiality, Curry said to, according to the AP at the time, confidentiality is important to allow investigators to continue their work independently and to avoid material prejudice in the matter. And yet State Police Superintendent, again, Mike Pence's State Police Superintendent, Doug Carter, had gone out, had been very vocal about charges of voter fraud. He had appeared on local TV saying things like, quote, there's voter fraud and voter forgery in every state of America. That was the superintendent of the state police in Indiana, work under Mike Pence, under the charge of Mike Pence at the time. Mike Pence, who joined in with the chorus on behalf of Donald Trump to claim, oh, you know what? Well, we had to get rid of James Comey because he said inappropriate things before an election, and law enforcement officials should never be doing that. They might prejudice the election. And yet his own state police superintendent was doing exactly that. And Mike Pence, no, did not go out and fire him, did he? The way Donald Trump fired Comey months and months later. Curry said in his statement he was worried that investigators were making statements about the alleged voter fraud case. This is Curry, the prosecutor, before the evidence was actually in. And he had encouraged the state police to stop speaking publicly about the investigation until they have finished their work. So this is like weeks after this raid. They have been talking about it the whole time. They had raided, TPM points out they had confiscated computers, cell phones, other records. As I said, they were looking into potential allegations of voter registration fraud by the Indiana Voter Registration Project. The group focused on registering African American voters in Indiana. Now, the Indiana Voter Registration Project had actually hired a group called Target Smart who determined that it wasn't their registrations that were bad. They were coming back and they were getting a lot of bad records. Instead, it was actually old information in the state's voter database for some 800,000 voters, which made some of their information look like it didn't match. Their new information didn't seem to match the old information. So Desi Doyen, if you had been registered at some address in Indiana and then you moved, and you filled out a form with...
I re-registered as one would normally do with my new address.
With this group, and that got turned in, they'd say, aha, look, they're changing Desi Doyen's address. It's fraud. And apparently, they had found, when they looked at the data, some 800,000 old, dead, bad registrations. That happens. People die. People move. They move from county to county. They move from state to state. But they ended up with, you know, hundreds of thousands of bad data in the state's database. Now, Mother Jones said that the state police had stated in affidavits released after the election that they believed that among the thousands of registration forms the group turned in were some that appeared to have been forged. From the evidence presented, it seemed likely that a few canvassers had, in fact, fraudulently filled out applications, but Patriot Majority USA claimed that it was vindicated by the release of those documents, in addition to apparent evidence of forged applications, because they showed that the group staff had actually flagged those suspect applications for county authorities. So in cases where you had a temporary worker who was hired to do registration and they put some information on there that they shouldn't have, the group had flagged it and turned it in. The process worked. One of the folks with Patriot Majority USA conceded that it's possible that a few canvassers had broken the rules and forged applications, but that could not account for the accusation of large-scale fraud that was coming out of the Secretary of State's office and out of state police. She had said, remember, thousands of dates of birth and first names were changed, she claimed in a statement back in October of 2016. And yet there is no evidence that any fraudulent ballots were ultimately cast in the state of Indiana. None. And everyone has since forgotten about all of that voter fraud after the election was over, it seems. They forgot about Mike Pence going out and declaring all of this voter fraud. In late January, the state police finished their investigation. They turned it over to the Marion County prosecutor to determine whether to file any charges. There have been no charges filed. Contrary to Pence's statement a spokeswoman for the prosecutor's office stressed that the police had not investigated voter fraud. They were looking at voter registration discrepancies, and that the investigation was not into fraudulent voting. That would be ballots being cast improperly. McLeish, the spokesperson, told Mother Jones they had not yet decided whether to press charges. So shortly before leaving office, Mike Pence, when he left the governor's office to become vice president, by the way, he awarded Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson the state's highest civilian honor. And about a week or so ago, that office, the Indiana Secretary of State's office, removed about 500,000 registrations from the rolls because they said, oh, yeah, these are old and out of date. Pretty much exactly what the Indiana Voter Registration Project had tried to tell them at the time. But the deed was done.
was wrong. Figured I'd write it in a hip-hop song.
You've reached the activism portion of today's show. Now that you're informed and angry, here's what you can do about it. Today's activism, call out voter suppression with Let America Vote. There was some good news this week on voting rights in North Carolina, thanks to the Supreme Court, but the existential crisis still continues. It's no coincidence that by Election Day last fall, the Voting Rights Act had been gutted, there were new voting restrictions in 14 states, and states with histories of voter discrimination had 868 fewer polling places. This is the result of a strategic Republican assault on voting rights, and it's Trump's and the Republicans' long game for winning in 2018, 2020, and beyond. Now, Trump, who 6 months after the election is still taking any chance he gets to bring up that he won the Electoral College, has launched his promised voter fraud commission. In true Trump style, this charade is led by people formerly accused of voter suppression. The ACLU immediately responded with Freedom of Information Act requests to officials in four states and the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. For years now, the right and their Fox News megaphone have been able to sow enough fear and doubt using false claims of voter fraud without any evidence to back them up that Republican voters now see things like voter ID laws as necessary protections to democracy. It's unclear if we can bring them back to reality, but for those ready to take on the politicians, including Trump, who are propagating these lies and suppressing votes, there is a new organization you should know about. Let America Vote was founded by former Missouri Secretary of State and recent congressional candidate Jason Kander. The organization aims to answer a simple question: what if politicians were actually held publicly accountable for supporting voter suppression? Through online and grassroots organizing, an aggressive earned media strategy, and advertising, Let America Vote wants to play a crucial role among the existing network of organizations fighting for voting rights. They've already launched digital ads during New Hampshire's special elections and called out Karen Handel, the Republican running in Georgia's 6th District, for an almost laughable anti-voter rights email she sent to supporters. Head over to letamericavote.org to get involved by signing up for updates, volunteering to knock on doors, call or email legislators, write letters to the editor, host a voting rights house party, and more. While you're there, check out the interactive map of the U.S. that highlights each state's current and pending voter suppression laws and tactics. You can also follow the organization on Twitter at @let_AmericaVote. The segment notes include all of the links to this information, as well as additional resources, and as always, this and every activism segment we produce is archived and organized under the Activism tab at bestoftheleft.com. So if protecting voter rights for all Americans is important to you, be sure to hit the share buttons to spread the word about calling out voter suppression with Let America Vote via social media so that others in your network can spread the word too.
Activism. Come on out from in front of the television. Bust out of your self-imposed media prison. There's a whole big world out there, y'all. And some serious stuff is going down. Civil war, intolerance, AIDS, obliteration. The usual madness, but not enough frustration about what's troubling Earth's nations. The spotlight will not be your savior in these dark days, and it will not be your saving grace. Why not replace your dreams of gracing life's stage?
Voting rights activists are expressing alarm after President Donald Trump signed an executive order Thursday creating a presidential advisory commission on election integrity. The move comes after Trump repeatedly claimed that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in November because between 3 and 5 million people voted illegally. No evidence has ever been presented backing up his claim. On Thursday, Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders unveiled the plan for the new election integrity commission.
I'd like to announce that the president also just signed another executive order establishing the bipartisan Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. The commission will review policies and practices that enhance or undermine the American people's confidence in the integrity of federal elections and provide the president with a report that identifies system vulnerabilities that lead to improper registrations and voting.
Civil rights groups and several Democratic lawmakers denounced the Election Integrity Commission, suggesting it's designed to perpetuate the myth of voter fraud as a pretense for new policies that'll make it harder to vote. Policies such as voter ID laws, eliminating early voting, and prohibiting same-day voter registration. Particularly worrying to voting rights activists is the selection of Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach as the vice chair of the commission. Kobach has pushed for the strictest voter identification immigration laws in the country and advocated for a proof of citizenship requirement at the state and federal levels. Meanwhile, a new report has called into question whether President Trump would have actually won Wisconsin during the 2016 presidential election without the state's strict voter ID law. The study published by the progressive advocacy group Priorities USA says the law suppressed the votes of more than 200,000 residents, the majority of whom were African American and Democratic leaning. President Trump won only about 23,000 more votes than Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin. Well, for more, we're joined by Ari Berman, senior contributing writer for The Nation, where he covers voting rights. His recent piece is headlined, "Trump's Commission on Election Integrity Will Lead to Massive Voter Suppression." Explain why, Ari.
Well, I think it's, first off, it's important to note this is not an election integrity commission. This is a voter suppression commission because there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud to investigate. Everyone who's looked at this, including Trump's own lawyers, during the recounts in Michigan and other states have said that the election was not tainted by fraud. So the only reason to do this and the only reason to announce it this week, other than to soothe Trump's ego, other than to distract from the news about Comey and Russia, is to perpetuate the myth of voter fraud in order to lay the groundwork for policies that will suppress the vote.
So explain what the commission is all about, how it came about, what its history is, and what exactly it's going to do.
So I guess you could say the roots of it happened after the election when Trump startled everyone by saying that he would have won the popular vote except for the fact that millions of people voted illegally. He's subsequently tweeted this. He subsequently said it. He's provided no evidence for these claims. And so it's an attempt, just like what he said about wiretapping. There was no evidence of it. Then he calls for an investigation. And so basically, he manufactured this issue. There was no evidence. And now we have an entire presidential commission designed to investigate it. There's going to be taxpayer money. Some of the heaviest hitters in the Republican Party are part of this commission. And I think it's easy to just dismiss it as another laughable thing that Trump is doing to try to distract from the news. But the real worry here is that they're going to say all of these outlandish things about voter fraud. It's going to have the veneer of a presidential commission. And then they're going to say, oh, by the way, there's all this voter fraud. And now we should pass strict voter ID laws. We should pass proof of citizenship laws. We should cut early voting. We should purge the voting rolls. We shouldn't just do it in the states where it's already happening. We should do it on the national and federal level as well. So the president of the United States endorsing a policy of voter suppression is absolutely chilling.
So, as you said, in January, President Trump called for this major investigation of voter fraud as he continued to falsely assert he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton because 3 to 5 million unauthorized votes were cast in the election. So ABC anchor David Muir questioned Trump about those claims.
When you say, in your opinion, millions of illegal votes, that is something that is extremely fundamental to our functioning democracy, a fair and free election.
Sure.
You say you're going to launch an investigation into this.
Sure, done.
What you have presented so far has been debunked. It's been called false.
Take a look at the Pew reports.
I called the author of the Pew report last night, and he told me that they found no evidence of voter fraud.
Really? Then why did he write the report?
He said no evidence of voter fraud.
Excuse me. Then why did he write the report? According to Pew report. Then he's groveling again. You know, I always talk about the reporters that grovel when they want to write something that you want to hear, but not necessarily millions of people want to hear or have to hear.
So that's Donald Trump. Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach defended Trump's unfounded claim that millions of people illegally voted, supposedly costing Trump the popular vote. This is Kobach being questioned by reporters.
I think the president-elect is absolutely correct when he says the number of illegal votes cast exceeds the popular vote margin between him and Hillary Clinton at this point.
What tangible evidence is there that that actually happened?
Well, this is the problem with aliens voting and aliens registering. There's no way you can look on the voter rolls and say, this one's an alien, this one's a citizen, this one's an alien. Once a person gets on the voter rolls, you don't have any way of easily identifying them as aliens. And so you have to rely on post-election studies like the Cooperative Congressional Election Survey, where you get data from aliens themselves saying, oh, yeah, I voted. it does appear that aliens do vote in very large numbers.
That was Crisco back in November, right after the election, Ari Berman.
So all of the available evidence shows that voter fraud is a very small problem in American elections, and that non-citizens voting is an even smaller problem in American elections. Because just think about it, Amy. If you're a non-citizen and you vote, you're risking deportation, you're risking a felony, you're risking never being able to vote again if you become a U.S. citizen. So all of these things are a huge risk to somebody. And people who are here either illegally or here legally but are non-citizens, the last thing they want to do is vote and get deported. So this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Just the numbers that we have show that in the 2016 election, the Washington Post found only 4 documented cases of voter fraud out of 135 million votes cast. It was 0.00002% of total votes. State-based reviews since then have found at most a few hundred alleged cases of voter fraud, not millions. In Kansas, Chris Kobach is the only Secretary of State in the country with the power to prosecute voter fraud cases. He's only convicted 9 people of voter fraud since 2014 out of 1.8 million registered voters in that state. He's only convicted 1 non-citizen of voting. So if this problem was as widespread—
Did they vote for Trump?
There was a different non-citizen who voted in Texas, not knowing that she was unable to vote. Because usually this is what it is. If you're a non-citizen and you vote, it's usually because you believe you're qualified, because you have documents like a green card or like a driver's license, and you believe that you're part of the political process. And they may ask you at the DMV, do you want to register to vote? And you say yes, but it's nothing nefarious here. There was another case of someone who voted twice in Iowa for Donald Trump because she believed his claims that the elections were going to be rigged. So I'm not saying this never happens, but it's a very, very, very small problem. And usually it's human error, not some sort of massive conspiracy underway.
We just heard clips today, starting with Start Making Sense, discussing where voting rights stand now with Ari Berman. The David Pakman Show broke down the new study that showed 200,000 votes were suppressed in Wisconsin alone. The Other Washington explained all, or at least many, of the benefits of vote-by-mail systems. The Bradcast explained Mike Pence's role in suppressing votes in Indiana before the election. Our activism for today is in support of the new organization Let America Vote. And finally, we just heard Democracy Now! Explain Trump's new election integrity, those are giant air quotes, commission being run by all of the major vote suppression players in the Republican Party. You can find links to each of these segments in the show notes for easy reference and sharing. And now we'll hear from you.
Hi, Jay. It's Dave from Olympia, Washington. I was just calling to follow up on the conversation around free speech and anti-fascist protests. And I think there's something contextual about, like, at least my feelings on free speech. When, and I have this distinct memory, literally on the day we were unpacking the moving van, moving into Olympia, there was a gathering of the Nazi party at the state capitol. And they were down there, and there was a dozen yahoos, and there were 500 people gathered to make fun of them. And they didn't feel threatening. And so it's, oh yeah, they totally have the right to say, what they want. And, we have the right to do a counter protest. That's all great. And free exchange of ideas. But when those ideas begin to gain traction, it changes your perspective. It's suddenly much scarier, much more dangerous. A tiger at a zoo is fascinating and beautiful and very, very, you can appreciate how wonderful it is, alone at night in the jungle with tigers out there that are a real threat. It's a different relationship to the threat. So I thought I'd just share that perspective, if that adds anything to the conversation. I don't know if it does. Anyhow, that's what I was thinking about. As always, Jay, thank you for everything you do. Stay awesome.
Hey, Jay, this is Jack from Atlanta. I wanted to add to what you were saying about the issue of free speech, and I think his name was Trent, is that right? I'm sorry if I got your name wrong. But Trent, that's his name, had asked you about your opinion, and you'd given it, but I think you left out one thing. When you were talking about Robert Reich and Ann Coulter, I think the issue here is that the media in general, in America at least, does not want to give the left, and by the left I mean what the media calls the far left or the hard left or whatever, a voice. And that is the issue here. So, you know, somebody like Robert Reich can talk all about freedom of speech and agree with Ann Coulter, but that other voice, as exemplified by the clip that you gave, and I kind of can't remember the source, but it was a very coherent argument for, you know, suppression of certain ideas, made a lot of sense to me. And again, that, I think that point that the left doesn't have a voice shows why, you know, America isn't quite as free as people believe. Anyway, that's all I have to add. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to the volunteers who helped gather clips to make this show possible. Thanks to Amanda Hoffman for all of her work on our social media outlets and activism segments. And thanks to all those who called into the voicemail line. If you'd like to leave a comment, question, or explanation of something so we all understand it better, simply record a message at 202-999-3991. Now, I want to go over these voter ID laws just one more time from a ever so slightly different angle. We've already established that they are unnecessary because voter fraud is almost non-existent in this country. And secondly, that they are designed specifically to disenfranchise people who are more likely to vote Democratic. And that can be broken down in a lot of different ways. People who have less money are definitely more likely to vote Democratic, and people of non-white races are more likely to vote Democratic. And all of those constituencies, and younger people definitely more likely to vote Democratic, and all of those constituencies are targeted because they are less likely to have the types of IDs that these new laws are insisting people have. And these pseudo-rational arguments come up saying that because the law doesn't specifically say that anyone is being discriminated against, and it says, hey, just everyone needs to have the same thing, therefore it's a completely across the board even treating of everyone, and, you know, you have to have an ID, all ID, you know, you can get an ID for free whether you're rich or poor or black or white, it doesn't matter, you all have to have the same ID and you can all get it in the same way. So it sounds nice and you know, equal that way, but here's another way to look at that. The way to describe that could just as easily be the people for whom the system is working the least. Those are the people who are going to, on average, be much less likely to have a state-issued ID for a whole variety of reasons, mostly socioeconomic, but it could be other reasons. And so when you argue falsely, by the way, that, for instance, you have to have an ID to get on a plane. First of all, that's not true. I've actually gotten on a plane without an ID before. Just, you know, I have an ID, forgot it. They, you know, put you through more of a screening, but yeah, they let you on the plane anyway. But what people don't even realize they're arguing in that case is people who are rich enough to fly on planes, by and large, also have the IDs that they ask you for at the airport. But what about all the people who aren't rich enough to fly on planes? They have a lot less need for that kind of an ID. Same with just driving. A lot of people don't own cars and are dependent on public transportation. Again, those people are far less likely to already have the forms of identification needed for these new voter ID laws. And of course, that goes right into getting those free IDs. Oh, sure, you can just, you know, go down to your local office and pick one up, however far away that office is. But again, it's a whole lot easier to get to that office if you drive and already have at least that one form of ID. If you don't drive and don't have that ID, you have to go to the office and get one, but you have to take public transportation, or because of your socioeconomic status, you are a lot more dependent on your job and you don't have the time or ability to take time off, well, then it's a lot harder, again, to go get that ID. So this is all pretty straightforward. This is how a law can be written that looks even and balanced,
but very clearly disadvantages some over others. But to look past it just a little bit deeper and recognize what that actually means in real life, that the people for whom the system is already not working as well as compared to others, they are the ones who are being most highly impacted and are then discouraged the most from voting. The people who very likely need to voice their dissatisfaction with the current state of things, who may want to voice that the system is not working. Look, I am one of the people who's falling through the cracks. Let's vote people into office who will fix these systemic problems that are afflicting me in some way or another. Those are the people whose voices are being silenced the most. And the flip side of that is the people for whom the system is already working the best, on average, are the people whose voices are being heard loud and clear. So I just want to try framing it in this slightly different way to, first of all, dispel the arguments that these laws are fair because they theoretically apply to everyone equally. They clearly are not, because they impact people very, very differently. But secondly, to bypass the hang-ups people often have about race. Very clear and easy arguments can be made that these laws are inherently racist because they disproportionately affect people of color. But people don't necessarily understand what that means. I certainly feel like I understand what it means, but if you're talking to someone who thinks that calling a law like this racist implies or bluntly states that the people who wrote the law are specifically malicious against people of color, well, then they're going to either defend against that point or they're going to turn off their brains and not listen because they think it's an absurd point. And what I'm trying to say is it doesn't matter the intention of the people who wrote the law. It doesn't matter who they were trying to target or for what reason. What I'm laying out is that it is abundantly clear that it targets people for whom the system is not working. That can apply just as easily to a poor, straight white guy as it can to anyone else. And so, yes, a poor, straight white person will have many, if not all, of the same hurdles as a poor black person. This is not lost on me, and it should make you just as angry, no matter who is being disenfranchised and unable to vote. But the fact is that the people for whom the system is not working, on average, are far more likely to vote for the Democratic Party or for progressive politicians than for Republicans. And the people for whom the system is already working pretty well, they are far more likely to be conservative and just want things to continue on. They're fine with the status quo. And that is the only reason that this has become a political issue. If both political parties had equal incentive to get as many voters out to the polls as possible and vigorously campaign and convince as many people as possible that they are the right candidate for the job, then this would not be an issue. So the point is to pull out from the minutia and just ask that key question, who benefits? 9 times out of 10, that one question will get you closer to the truth than any others. Now, just real quick before I go, a last reminder that On the Media is WNYC Studios' weekly podcast investigating how the media shape our worldview. Hosts Brooke Gladstone and Bob Garfield are here to offer help if you, like them, are questioning the very nature of our reality. In a political and cultural moment so nerve-wracking, On the Media provides a weekly dose of sanity. So get On the Media on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, as always, keep the comments coming in. The number to dial, 202-999-3991. That's going to be it for today. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to those who support the show by becoming a member or making one-time donations, as that is absolutely how the program survives. Of course, everyone can support the show just by telling everyone you know about it and leaving glowing reviews on iTunes and Stitcher. Help us in our mission to aggregate and amplify the best progressive media by joining up with us on Facebook and Twitter and sharing all of the great content we're putting out there. And for details on the show itself, including links to all of the sources and music used in this and every episode, All that information can always be found in the show notes on the blog. So coming to you from inside the Beltway yet outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you every Tuesday and Friday, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show from bestoftheleft.com. And it's a crying shame how we get so trained. We can't see past our own sad stories and wonder what we're missing. We can't see past our own sad stories and forget how to listen. We can't see past our own sad stories and wonder.